From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
East Bay, El Cerrito.
West Oakland.
Richmond, California.
I live in Oakland, California. How you doing?
Coming up, we revisit Oakland's San Antonio district, where activists and residents continue their fight to reclaim an old neighborhood library.
It's become a place where people like to come and hang out for a minute and read a book and talk to their neighbors and, like, you know, have their children play and do something constructive.
Then we'll hear from the director of Fruitvale Station, the new film about Oscar Grant that's helping tell a more complete story about African-American males in the media.
For me, the film is about the film is about humanity.
And Muslim women artists speak out in a new online exhibit.
And how do you not define yourself based on what others are saying?
Telling the full story today on Cross Currents. On an early August morning last year, a group of activists quietly entered a building that had become an eyesore in East Oakland's San Antonio district. For more than 10 years, this vacant city-owned property attracted criminal elements in the community, including prostitution and violence. Local resident Moises Ramirez said it was time for a change.
I would like to see things be more peaceful, more secure, and with more light.
The building was a gift from Andrew Carnegie back in 1918. It had been used as a city branch library until 1976, but was left empty after 2001. So the organizers brought cleaning supplies and some books and began reclaiming the space as a library with the idea of adding a community garden. Local residents like Moises Ramirez saw what was happening and enthusiastically joined the efforts to bring some life back into the area. But the organizers hadn't asked for city permission before they went in, something the city had a problem with. At the time, Deputy City Administrator Arturo Sanchez said the library takeover wasn't good for the long term.
There's an old proverb that the road to, I think that it's hell, is paved with good intentions, and there's a right way and a wrong way to do things, and we would prefer as a city to make sure that we do things right, correctly, and safely.
The city told the occupants they were trespassing and forced everyone out. But now, a year later, the building remains vacant and its future uncertain. KALW's Kyungjin Lee visited the People's Library when it first opened last year and again recently to see how the activists plan to move forward with their vision for the building.
When you walk into the People's Library now, the first thing you see isn't books. It's vegetables.
I made this box and I'm planting radish, lettuce, broccoli, and I think that's all.
10-year-old Fabian Sanchez got involved in the garden with his family last year. He mostly lives in Sacramento, but when he comes to see his dad in Oakland, he visits the garden as often as he can.
I don't see nothing.
Yeah.
Oh, wait.
There's something.
We just planted them a few days ago. So these are the first sprouts.
Oh, that's so exciting.
I think, what did you call them the other day? What did you call this big sprout?
The Big Show.
The Big Show. That's the Big Show right there.
That's so cool.
The garden now has 8 planter boxes, bursting with fruits and vegetables.
We have some squash, kale, little baby tomatoes. We have some, adult tomatoes over there. Broccoli. There's a lot of squash there. You can look inside. Some of these are really big now. There you go. They're going to get big.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's like a newborn.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on.
You'll eventually notice the books, too. Some shelves here and a milk crate there. On the day I visit, a couple of neighborhood men are sitting by a stack of books reading and just chilling in the evening breeze. About a dozen kids play while parents chat and supervise. Organizer Jaime Yassin still drops by a few times a week, and he says this kind of scene is pretty common.
It's become a place where people like to come and hang out for a minute and read a book and talk to their neighbors and, like, you know, have their children play and do something constructive.
The intersection where the library is located is littered with trash. I also saw a few dumped mattresses and a decomposed possum. Against that backdrop, the garden and library are a welcomed oasis.
Como estaba abandonado, lo ocupan para muchas cosas.
When the building's abandoned, it's occupied by people who do bad things. So any organization that'll take it over and convert it would be a positive change for the community.
Neighborhood resident Zenobia Vasquez has continued to lead the efforts to keep the garden project going. He says the area has gotten a little bit better.
When they see there's people working here, the people who want to come in to do violent things stay away.
Still, the abandoned building itself can attract crime. Oakland City Councilman Noel Gallo says he knows that's a problem and that the garden helps. He took office after the initial action and remembers his first impressions.
The garden was really clean, well taken care of. You know, the neighbors, kids were using it. I saw the book stands on the outside and I saw kids going there. And that's a good thing.
But still, technically illegal. Gallo says he doesn't mind the neighbors using the space, but the city has to decide what to do with it. Still, he says, he understands the activist predicament.
The city does not want to fix it, but they don't want you to use it either.
Gallo says there have been several inquiries about the building, including from schools and a nonprofit, but the city hasn't made a move yet. When I ask around, the director of an Alameda charter school said she's particularly interested in the location because so many of her students come from this area. But, she told me, she hasn't been able to even see the building. Garden organizer Jaime Yacine says her experience isn't unusual.
No one who wants to buy this building has yet been able to get into the building to see what they need to do to buy the building.
He doubts a deal is likely to happen anytime soon. In the meantime, there's kind of a status quo. Yacine says the city shut them down a few times initially, but that it's been pretty quiet for the past 6 months. In that time, the garden's taken on a life of its own.
The cool thing at this point is now that, like, when we come here, sometimes we find things planted that you don't know where they came from. And so that bucket over there with something in it, I don't even know what that is, and I'm happy to not know.
Councilman Gallo says he plans to walk through the library with interested investors this week. And until something happens, Zenobia Vasquez says he'll continue to improve the reclaimed space.
We're going to build a little house where the library is, so when it rains, we don't have to deal with the books getting wet. And we're working to fix the gardens and plant more seeds so anyone who comes to study can smell the scent of flowers.
In East Oakland, I'm Kyungjin Lee for Cross Currents.
Neighborhood residents will hold a one-year anniversary barbecue on Saturday, August 17th at 1449 Miller Avenue at 2 p.m. So what do you think should happen to the shuttered library building? Let us know on our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now we take another look at life in East Oakland, specifically at the life of one resident, Oscar Grant, which came to a sudden end in the early hours of New Year's Day in 2009. Grant was fatally shot by BART officer Johannes Meserly after an altercation. Meserly was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter and served 11 months of a two-year sentence. Earlier today, a federal appeals court ruled that Grant's family and friends can file a civil lawsuit against Meserly and the other officers involved. The movie Fruitvale Station follows Grant, a young African-American man, on the last day of his life. It follows him around Oakland, on a BART ride to San Francisco and back, and to the platform where he died. The film's limited release 3 weeks ago fell on the same weekend that a jury in Sanford, Florida, found George Zimmerman not guilty of the murder of another young African-American man, Trayvon Martin. Both events sparked a national conversation about race and our justice system. Turnstile News reporter Nishat Kurwa says this confluence of national news and landmark black cinema is significant, but not a first.
So you gonna leave me? You gonna leave me again? What kind of mom is you?
I love you, Oscar.
You don't love nothing.
I do. And I'm praying for you.
George Zimmerman was found not guilty of the murder of Trayvon Martin on the same weekend that Fruitvale Station hit theaters here in Oakland, California, depicting the killing of another unarmed young black man, Oscar Grant. Tweets about the Zimmerman verdict paired the hashtags Oscar Grant and Trayvon Martin as the same story, different state. The timing of Fruitvale Station is more than a little eerie, and when director Ryan Coogler discusses it, he's cautious, almost apologetic sounding, saying he didn't anticipate the two would become linked.
People draw a lot of parallels between what happened with Oscar and what happened with Trayvon. And I think that for me, the film is about humanity, and it's about really relationships, you know what I mean? And the relationships that are left behind when a human being's life is cut short.
Still, it seems inevitable that the film will benefit from the publicity. First of the verdict, and then of President Obama's surprise remarks about its aftermath. Coogler has been widely lauded by critics for his humanizing portrait of Grant, as a doting father, a not-quite-reformed weed dealer, a recently unemployed young adult, and a tender son. A less widely hailed but just as significant feature of the movie is its representation of the Bay Area's racial dynamics. Audiences see Grant interact fluidly with people of diverse ethnicities. It happens both in casual exchanges and in deeper relationships of the sort that are the norm in this diverse region, where even racial animus doesn't always conform to the black-white binary that's so common elsewhere in the country. Coogler says that's simply a reflection of Grant's life.
He had friends that were Hispanic friends, that were, you know, Filipino friends, that were Indian, you know what I mean, white friends. You know, that's kind of how it goes in the Bay in many ways. It's not a racial utopia, but it is a diverse place. Issues of race come up, as they did that night, obviously, you know, but at the same time, you know, he was a product of his environment and he came from a very diverse environment.
When I asked about the inspiration for the character, other depictions of black men that normalize them and highlight their humanity, Coogler said he was mostly inspired by real people, but he did offer one reference point that sheds light not only on the state of black cinema, but on racial understanding in America.
Same. Y'all come from Compton.
Yeah.
I thought you were scared of Compton,
man. Rick was a
Director John Singleton's Boys in the Hood came out in 1991, and it was controversial and groundbreaking. It was an insider's perspective on the perils and beauty of life in the hood and the hazards of being young, black, and male in America. And like Fruitvale Station, the conditions that the story brought to light were also reflected in a contemporaneous bit of citizen journalism. The video that showed Rodney King being beaten by the LAPD was also seen by national audiences that year. And in 1992, South Central Los Angeles erupted in protest. For many non-black audiences, news stories like these or racially polarizing characters on reality TV are what shape their perception of young black males. Darnell Hunt is director of UCLA's Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies. He says it's rare that Hollywood films present counter-narratives to those vilified depictions.
Every once in a while, you have an exception to the rule, like Fruitvale Station or even Boys in the Hood, which unfortunately spawned a series of quote-unquote copycat films that I don't feel were as authentic and as sort of community-oriented as I think the impulse behind Boys in the Hood was. You know, but the industry is not exactly chomping at the bit to make these types of films, films about the inner thoughts and feelings of members of the black community. That's just not something that the Hollywood industry typically does.
This is why Fruitvale Station is ripe with potential. The film is rolling out in theaters across an illusory post-racial America, which in many areas is resegregating or experiencing deep economic inequality. Two decades after Boys in the Hood, here's a movie by a young black director taken up by Hollywood that feels a bit like a cinematic handbook for stories that the country needs to see at a difficult time.
For me, like hearing about what happened with Trayvon, you know, was a tragedy in February, you know what I mean, in 2012, when we were already working on the film then, and the news came out about it, and I was just thinking about how often, you know, young African-American males die in the streets every day. You know, in Oscar's situation, it was a police officer that shot him, you know what I mean? In Trayvon's situation, it was somebody who wasn't even a cop that killed him. But so often, every day, we're killing ourselves, you know what I mean, as well.
Fruitvale Station depicted Grant as his family saw him. Not exceptional, not a hero, but a human. Some Bay Area viewers say that unlike the real-life drama in Oakland, the film brought some closure and a feeling far from disappointment. In the courtroom in Sanford, Florida, Trayvon Martin's family did not see their son's story redeemed. During the trial, Martin himself was first depicted as a pothead and then a thug. He became a vessel for other people's narratives. Fruitvale Station sold out in all seven cities where it premiered on the weekend the verdict came down. It's possible that if it continues to do well, it could fuel Hollywood's appetite for more thoughtful stories like it. And if it doesn't? Unlike the aftermath of Boys in the Hood 20 years ago, there's a growing contingent of young filmmakers recognizing that their path to wider audiences and creative control may not tread through Hollywood, but through independent distribution and the internet. For Cross Currents, I'm Nishat Kirwa.
That story was produced by Turnstile News, the tech and digital culture site from Youth Radio. You can find more stories from Turnstile and Youth Radio at klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. As Fruitvale Station attempts to shed light on what it means to be an African-American male in Oakland, there's a local exhibit that takes a deeper look at another often misrepresented community, and that's Muslim women around the world. It's called Muslima, Muslim Women's Arts and Voices, and it's at the International Museum of Women, based here in San Francisco. Well, it's virtually based here, because the museum is actually online. For this latest exhibit, the museum partnered with museums in Denmark, the Philippines, and the United Arab Emirates to reach out to painters, authors, poets, writers, sculptors, artists of all kinds in a mass movement of self-expression. The result is an eclectic online exhibit of art reflecting the complexity of what it means to be a Muslim woman, spiritually, socially, sexually, artistically, away from what the mainstream media brings to our screens. San Francisco author Samina Ali curated the exhibit. She came by our studios and I asked her why she felt the exhibit was necessary. And full disclosure here, I was chosen to be part of this exhibit.
I spoke recently to a large group of graduate students here in San Francisco. And one of the questions I asked this group of intellectuals is, what is the first image you have when I ask you about a Muslim woman? And intellectuals in San Francisco,
at Stanford,
yes, said they're weak, they're veiled, they lack agency, they're submissive, they're illiterate. So if you think this is what's happening here, what's happening elsewhere with groups who aren't intellectuals, with groups who aren't actively trying to undo these stereotypes? If these are the first thoughts that come to their mind when I say Muslim woman, that's problematic. And it means that we as a nation have deeply internalized our image. A very disempowering, very disrespectful even, image of Muslim women. So one of the things that the exhibition is trying to do is to bring together all of these voices of Muslim women and to present them unfiltered. And I think that I want to underline unfiltered because it's Muslim women speaking directly, whether it's through their art or through their writing or through their activism, to the viewers who come to the exhibition. And you will see through the diversity of voices and the diversity of expressions that Muslim women live these very rich lives. Not every woman is facing the same issues. And in fact, every woman faces a different set of issues depending on where she lives in the world, just as anyone else does.
Which sounds a little ridiculous to have to say. Like you're sitting there saying, you know, these women have different, you know, lives. You know, why would that be kind of a given for anyone else? But it has to be stated like that when you're talking about Muslim women.
It's an unfortunate ramification of 9/11, I think. And I think also it goes back to pre-9/11 with, you know, the history of imperialism in the Middle East. And I mean, when you think about the images that came out for Muslim women and the harem, for example. And so I think then you had Muslim women as being overly sexualized.
So you've chosen a group of artists, writers that are local to San Francisco, and where? Tell me about that.
Well, what we wanted to do was choose. The museum has partnered with three other museums. Those other three museums are in Denmark, in the Philippines, and in the United Arab Emirates. And in the four cities, including San Francisco, we wanted to have between 10 to 15 representatives from the local area who are artists, emerging leaders, women, Muslim women who are really bringing, you know, really contributing. And so those women are all part, and these women also represent, and this is an important part of the exhibition, they represent the future. This is the current young generation of Muslim women.
For our exhibit, for our portions of the exhibit as Muslima ambassadors, you made us write 6-word memoirs, which was so hard to do. So, as our fearless leader, I want you to think of one right now.
Oh, my God.
6-word memoir. This is payback.
Oh, my God. Payback, indeed. I guess in 6 words, when I look at what I've been doing for over a decade, my 6-word memoir would have to be creating a better future for children.
And that kind of leads into my last question for you. You have a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Is everything you're doing in terms of your activism and your writing and now the exhibit for her?
I actually have 2 children. I have my son is 13 and my daughter is 4.
And you feel this is equally important for the boy.
Absolutely.
And for the girl, not just important
no,
for her.
It's so important for both of them. I think that religion is so personal. Faith is one of the most personal things. And what's unfortunately happened with the Muslim community is that something that is so deeply personal has become one of the most public spaces. And how do you then take that back and make it personal? And how do you not define yourself based on what others are saying? So yes, it's important for me because I have both a boy and a girl to start helping them to define themselves, especially when they hear so many negative things about who they are.
What would you like to know about Muslim women's lives? Let us know on our Facebook page. We're KALW. That's also where we'll have a link to the exhibit. That's all for today's edition of Cross Currents. The team includes Isabel Angel, Julie Kane, Tiffany Kamhai, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Alyssa Kapnick, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Christina Loring, Daniel Moore, Liz Pfeffer, Mary Reese, Leah Rose, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel, who we're so happy for. He just got engaged to Cross Currents volunteer Alyssa Kapnick. Congratulations, you two. This is our first Cross Currents family marriage. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Treffney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. This is Stu Allen, along with Mars Hotel. Allen and fabled organist Melvin Seals headline the 11th annual Jerry Day this Sunday. Jerry Day takes place in the Jerry Garcia Amphitheater in San Francisco's Excelsior District. That's the neighborhood where the Grateful Dead guitarist grew up. Music starts at 11:30 a.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. Yay, Seth and Alyssa!